This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There are some things that we understand through facts, and then there are some that we may understand better through feeling. Poet Samaj Brown has spent most of her writing life with a foot in both worlds. In her passionate, evocative poems, the natural world and her community intertwine and connect again and again in surprising ways. As Flint's poet laureate, Brown has formalized her longtime education work while acting as a kind of medium and mirror for Flint's response to its water crisis. She recently published a book, Bleeding Fire, Tap the Eternal Spring of Regenerative Light, Conversations in Poetry and Prose, and we've invited her to talk to us about her work. Samaj Brown, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited.
You know, there are a few moments in the preface that have struck me again. I've gone back to that page several times in the past week or so. You write that in difficult times, there's much to do to redeem our world. The cynics say problems have always been here. I answer, you say, so too have solutions. Do you still feel that in this moment right now?
Yes, I do. I do. I feel that in this moment. We have to pull on all of our resources. And that means our spiritual resources, our social resources, our humanity, sometimes our great humanity that sometimes we just don't tap into on a regular basis because we're on a treadmill and we're doing so many things, task-oriented. So this is a time for us to step out of the skin that we usually wear and become transformative.
The selection of you as Flint's poet laureate is so timely, I feel, in so many ways, considering that you're also deeply concerned with, as you put it, the twirling twins of art and science. And it's something that, I mean, there are many artists who say that these fields both have resonance for them, but you have been breathing this air, I suppose we could say, for a long time. Could you talk a little bit about your grounding in both disciplines, either at Cass Tech or in your sort of adult professional career?
Well, certainly. It really began with my very formative years. So every other night, my mother would read poetry with me, and one night with my sister, one night with me. Poetry was so much a part of my life. I thought the poets were my relatives, poets of Broadside Press, the legacy poets like Audre Lorde and Dudley Randall. They were not my relatives. But as a little girl, they were so frequent in our home. And mother spoke about Gwendolyn Brooks as if she lived right around the corner. So that was my upbringing. And along with that, my grandmother every year, every summer, we studied in Stratford, Ontario, Shakespeare. And so literary arts were very much a part of my foundation. And then there was a science lab that was in the basement that I could just explore and grow crystals and do experiments. And so science and art melded in my brain. And then attending Cass Tech, we had these different curriculums. And I was in avocational music, which was lots of music, art, and science and mathematics. So it further reinforced the sameness of those two supposedly disparate disciplines. And I don't see them worlds apart. I see them as expressions of the same thing.
May I ask you to read for us?
Certainly. I will read Mother Ocean. And I'd like to give you a little background on Mother Ocean. For a long time here in Flint, once I married my husband, he's a medical doctor, and I started to work with him in the practice. And he asked me, I was going to do science consulting for the Flint Public Schools, and he asked me to help him get the word out by doing the kind of programming I do. And so I started to look at health and art and science and do this professional workshopping I do for his patients and then the community. And then we had a lot of things happen. So we're talking about a period of years, over a decade, where I wasn't writing serious poetry. I was writing curriculum and workshopping. And then the Flint Institute of Arts had an exhibit called Women of a New Tribe. It was an exhibit of African-American women in the community, all in black and white, by Jerry Taliaferro. It was a wonderful installation. That was in 2017. I was one of the subjects. And when the gallery opened, it was so beautiful. It inspired this poem called Mother Ocean, where it's filled with magical realism, where the ocean is personified. And the little river girl speaks to the ocean, and she says, "I talk to the ocean. I ask Mother Ocean, how long after middle passage did it take to heal your daughters, make them whole? How did you shape this distinct, beautiful creation?" And Mother Ocean answers in still serenity. And Mother Ocean says, "It's been 400 years. I sculpted them from promise. They were complete in the beginning, throughout, and remain whole today. Their memory was stolen. Their memory was stolen. Could not remember gold of Benin or family compounds, Acabulan, antiquity birthing science, Moorish, Spain, Timbuktu, world center of trade and scholarship, or origins of iron-forged French Quarter. Could not remember the military brilliance of Queen Nzinga or the original tongues of Fula and Yoruba." Mother Ocean continued. She said, "I fashioned each death new, molded feminine fluid into flesh, pooling ancient memories floating in time. They were recreated from the scarring flow of centuries, formed by amniotic river that pulse their veins. They speak the language of water now, and water is spirit, and spirit remembers. I am the ocean spirit remembering when they cannot." And so the poem has been called an epic poem, an odyssey of African-American history and culture, because it goes on and it goes through middle passage. Mother Ocean receives her daughters on the ocean floor, and she says that she never abandoned them. She was always with them. And they all the way to the Flint water crisis.
The imagery and balance in this work are so amazing. We should mention that a great deal of your work, it can be read on the page, but that you perform. And it's really hearing it read out loud is so essential to the full experience. This poem opens with a pretty essential question, though. How long to heal the wounds of the middle passage? How has poetry helped you with the process of shaping essential questions?
Well, I think poetry helps one to answer essential questions, or at least to clarify them. And so because poetry has the ability to be so intense and condense very complex ideas into a kernel, so that one can look at that kernel and maybe understand it better of whatever is going on.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Flint's poet laureate, Samaj Brown. Could you talk a little bit about how you've interpreted your role as Flint's poet laureate? You've had some time to work in this capacity now. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the experience has been like and what you feel you've learned from it and have been able to do?
Oh, certainly. So as poet laureate, my charge, every poet laureate has their own charge. And my charge is using poetry to teach literacy, reading and writing, while also incorporating the arts and sciences. So it's what I've been doing all along. So when I was teaching health care of programming, I would always incorporate the arts and sciences. I really don't know if I can do it any other way. That's the way my brain is fixed. So here as Poet Laureate, we are making games. Lots of fun. Because sometimes people have been traumatized by trying to read through the educational system. So instead of saying, oh, I'm going to teach reading and writing and have everyone shut completely down, I said, we're going to play a game. And so I create all of these games around words and give words currency, a value system, and synonyms. Instead of having spelling bees, we're having synonym bees. We're learning the nuances of all these words that have similar meanings, but when during usage, they may really have a huge difference. And so we're building vocabulary so that we can write poems and read poems and express ourselves because of the trauma that our community has experienced. Poetry is very important to allow people to write it out of them. You can literally write your emotions and put them on a piece of paper or on a computer screen. And then you can take them, if you so choose, and put them into performance, or perhaps put them in a book, or leave them there. Sometimes it's best just to leave them there.
And to have said it and to have spoken it and given word to it is enough.
Yes. And it's a way to step out of your experience and leave it there so that you may go on and write something different for yourself. So once you write your experience, and it was a hellish one, right? Mm-hmm. So now you have the power to write a new one. You're able to write your future. Poetry allows you to do that. It allows you to imagine, because without imagination, you don't exist as a human being. So I bring art to the curriculum. So students, young and old, can imagine their futures.
Samaj, there's some new data that's just come out within the last day or two from Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. And she's been looking over neuropsychological assessments and other testing of 174 kids in Flint. And just to summarize the findings, she suggests that more of Flint's kids need more help than we've really known to this point. Does that come as any surprise to you or to people in Flint, do you think?
No, I don't think so. It's a surprise to the probably communities and those listening to us now. But it's not a surprise to me because I'm here and I'm seeing what's going on and we're on the front line. And that's why the Poetry Pod Project is so important to be diffused in so many places all across the city. And we have partners. And the partners understand how important it is. And so the Flint Institute of Arts, along with University of Michigan English Department, to try and help to combat these horrible statistics. Because if we can affect children and people with music and art and poetry and science and combine them all and get them very excited about this. When you have a child that's motivated to learn, oh, your job as an educator is so much easier. So the question is, these children that have been so afflicted, how do we get them motivated to help themselves? Well, you do it through poetry. You do it through games, through making words fun. You teach in light, in color, in art, and you integrate it all together so it really speaks to their world and to a world that they can imagine. So that's critical. So the scores don't surprise me. I'm very aware, and that's why as my initiative, the Poetry Pod Project, that's why it's designed the way it's designed on so many different levels.
Would you tell us a little bit about ROAR?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So to put it in context, my work speaks to issues of women and subjugation, as well as human. This is a human issue. So when I think about little girls or little boys, for that matter, when I think about them playing and singing their little songs, and whether they're, back in my day, we did something called hopscotch. But now they do a lot of stepping and slapping. It's very rhythmic. And so what are they saying? So what if they were saying something like ABC, don't touch me. 4, 5, 6, none of your tricks. 7, 8, 9, if I say no, don't cross the line. So I could imagine children just playing, jump roping, and doing their stepping. And in their subconscious mind, they have these little rhymes that they're saying. Number two is, I imitate no one. I am the sole one. I am unique. If you can't see me, then you can't see. Glasses are what you need. Number three, no means hell no. I don't care if you go. In fact, I will leave. I can do as I please because I'm free, free, free.
When I think about girls on the playground and ropes and double dutch, I think about this moment of strength and athleticism and sort of living in one's body that maybe we don't see in girls' lives terribly often. And it was just so meaningful to find this image come up again in the poem, and to think about it as not just an isolated moment, but a springboard to further, to a source of strength. What was the physicality of that moment like for you when you were a kid? I should say, I don't know if you were much of a jumper.
Well, we ran and we played a great deal, and we rode our bikes for long distances, and then we would fall off, and we didn't have helmets, and we didn't have knee pads then. We didn't have anything.
Right.
We just got scarred up. It was terrible. But we knew, we really did know how to pick ourselves up, and we knew how to form groups and protect ourselves and stand up for ourselves. And I would like for our girls, because during the Me Too crisis, I heard so many women, young women, they weren't sure about the boundaries. They were confused. And I said, if we started at a young age teaching them with rhyme, explaining the boundaries, and they repeated it over and over again in play, so when perhaps a predator approaches them, they have it right on the tip of their tongue. It's been in their mind for so long, saying it over and over again, playing, that they're able to say, hey, don't touch me. Excuse me. No, absolutely not. So many girls don't know they have that. They haven't developed a voice. And my work is about women and girls having a voice. We must have voices.
You have spent so much time reckoning with the slow motion public health emergencies in Flint. And I mean, I think we can say with a relevance that really goes all throughout Michigan. The world is involved in something a little bit faster now. Do you see that changing your role at all?
I do. Being married to a medical doctor, we talk about it every morning and in the evening, and it's all happening rapidly. And we're talking about how best to protect ourselves, and since he's on the front line, how he can help the people. And my role, because I'm getting a lot of information, is to disseminate that information and to help clarify what's going on my Facebook page, in social media, because there's a lot of misinformation, of course, and not understanding why we must distance ourselves. And sometimes people are feeling put upon and inconvenienced.
One more thing to have to deal with amid everything else. Yeah,
exactly. But if we deal with this, what we have to deal with will be huge death.
I hope you will continue with all this work well beyond your tenure as poet laureate, as you did before you were ever announced. But I also, I kind of wanted to thank your husband, because I read in Bleeding Fire, the book, is that he really encouraged you to not consider your work and not just to publish a book of poetry in the form of just poetry, but it's obvious you two have had a big mutual effect on each other. He sounds like a cool guy.
Yes, you know, I'm going to tell you, if it were not for my husband, we would not have Bleeding Fire. But he came home one day and he said, why, out of the blue, I think I was cooking dinner. He said, why don't you have a book? And I said, well, I do have a book, because I was referring to the story cookbook that I did about all the vegetables, Feasts and Fables from the Planet Kingdom. It turned into a complete theatrical production. And so he said, no, why don't you have a book featuring your poetry and your curriculum and everything? And I was like, And I write this in the book, because it became a blur. All the things I had been doing for the last 20 years, including taking care of ill family members, being direct caregiver, and growing the practice and workshops throughout the city of Flint, and just on and on. And I realized why some books aren't written, because sometimes the things in the book are very painful and you have to revisit them. And you just really don't want to. But I did. And I'm personally better for it, going through it. And so it's not just a poetry book, and it's not just a book of essays. It's a combination where the essays help to contextualize the poems in many cases and give a history and a context. And that's what I think people want, because after all, poetry hasn't been the most accessible art form, if we want to be realistic about this.
This is true.
Right. So there are a lot of people who love art but don't necessarily care for poetry. But in this book, the poetry is contextualized, and the feedback has been enormous, because people love that, these essays and the context for the poems. And I think it makes it more accessible and friendly. And so I'm very happy for that. And I'm very grateful for my handsome hero.
Well, Samaj Brown, we're really, it feels just a little bit easier to face all the madness of the day, knowing that you two are out there helping us through it in this way. Thank you very much for your time and all of your poetry work.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I've had a great time.
Poet Samaj Brown. Her book, Bleeding Fire, can be found on Amazon.